Welcome back to Shattering This. I'm your host, Yada. We have a good friend of mine, a gentleman I've known for a very long time, an ex-Marine, an ex-Christian. As a matter of fact, an ex-Seventh-day Adventist on the line. His name is Don. And during the long series of shows that I did, I think I devoted an hour to renouncing the 28 edicts or pillars of Seventh-day Adventists over a course of probably 5 or 6 weeks. There's nothing that they profess that is true. But it's the problem of the Seventh-day Adventists is far greater than I realized. And since Don was a part of that organization, actually distributed literature on behalf of the organization, and the fact that there are over 20 million individuals worldwide who are beguiled by this religion, we wanted to have an opportunity to talk with Don about what he knew about the cult that is called the Seventh-day Adventists. Hello, Don. Welcome to Shattering This.
Shalom.
Yes, shalom. So, Don, why don't you share with our listeners a little bit, of your background with the Seventh-day Adventists.
Well, first of all, I want to make a confession to you.
Okay.
Are you ready to take a confession?
So long as you don't expect me to be able to do anything other than be able to listen. Because in the Catholic sense of confession and being absolved of your sins, I wasn't given that authorization and don't really want it.
Well, the reason I have to do this is I'm afraid that some of my readers to my website are going to find me out, and I thought I'd better confess it before they find it out.
Okay.
I pillaged that website.
Yes. You plagiarized it?
I plagiarized about 90%.
Yeah, I understand that is the case, but you had authorization, and if you have authorization, it's not plagiarism.
Oh, am I forgiven?
You are forgiven. See, I guess I can forgive. Yes. By the way, just so that our listeners know, Don has built a really wonderful website. I'm going to tell the folks the URL, the address of your website. Correct me if I misspeak, but it's YHWH, which are the four letters that comprise Yahweh's name, YHWH-QRA.com. Is that correct, Don?
Yes.
And there what you're going to find, it's a website that is devoted to Don's great affinity, his love of the Qumran scrolls, the Dead Sea Scrolls. And first, why don't you tell our listeners why you have an affinity for the Dead Sea Scrolls?
Well, I can thank the Seventh-day Adventists for that.
Okay.
They and I had a rather serious confrontation. I was a deacon. I was the leading deacon of a major SDA church in Southern California. And I had run into loggerheads with some of their top management on the Dead Sea Scrolls, which I had been desperately trying to find sources for.
Mm-hmm.
And this is part of the reason I wanted to talk to you about the SDAs. I was told from conference headquarters, I was actually called in and told from conference headquarters that the Dead Sea Scrolls were for Hebrew scholars and that Ellen G. White was the latest, I don't want to use scripture. That's bad. She never claimed to have anything to do with creating, writing, or interpreting. Well, yes, she did interpret scripture a lot, and she referred to her work as the testimonies. And
she claims to be a prophet. She claims to be inspired.
Well, yes, yes, but a prophet, no. She claims to be inspired.
Boy, that's not a pretty fine line in terms of the Seventh-day Adventist testimonies that I read, because without Helen White, the religion doesn't exist.
Oh, that's correct. That's correct. Let's not argue over the word prophet. She was self-proclaimed inspired. Shall we stop there?
Yeah, that'll be fine. So she claimed to be writing on behalf of her inspired revelations from God. It just so happens that everything she wrote is untrue and inconsistent with the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. But nonetheless, lots of people make those claims. Sadly, lots of people believe them.
That's the key. Inconsistent with the prophets.
Yes.
Psalms.
Yep.
Yes. But information from, as I say, the very top conference is that her testimonies are more accurate. And the Hebrew writings cannot be really interpreted correctly today into the English language.
And that's where
she stepped in.
And by the way, let me interrupt you just for a second. She was not a Hebrew scholar nor a Greek scholar. She didn't speak or read either Hebrew or Greek. So what they're trying to say is that she interpreted the English translations of Hebrew and Greek. She didn't have the capacity to read Hebrew or Greek.
But she was inspired.
Yes, of course. Of course. By the way, I'm inspired, too, every time that I read Yahweh's testimony in Hebrew, but not the same way she claims to be.
Well, I'm inspired every morning when I have to get up and do my bodily function. That's another inspiration. But you see, to a Seventh-day Adventist, especially the raised Seventh-day Adventist, such as I was, you're taught their publication network is incredible. It's one of the finest in the world. And their early books for childhood, you'll find in any dentist's office, any doctor's office, lawyer's, any professional office, you'll find the children's books and the young people's books on the desks, on the reading desk when you go and sit down and wait in the reading room. And we're indoctrinated from early on that E.G. White is the source. And, of course, her great controversy was written in 1890. I think the first was written around 1890.
Why don't you explain what the Greek controversy is? Because all I did is superficially described it as it's very similar to rabbinic Kabbalah, where there is this war between the good spirit and the bad spirit, and so it's a Kabbalic testimony. It has absolutely nothing to do with Yahweh and his testimony. Yahweh is not at war with the adversary Hasatan. Hasatan was created by Yahweh. He can lock him up and do away with him at any instant that he wishes to. They are not at war with one another.
No. No. But in the great controversy, they are. Kabbalah.
Yes. Kabbalah. Yes,
and
Kabbalah.
Yahweh is never mentioned anywhere in any of her writings.
Right. Yeah, she calls their God the Lord.
The Lord and Heavenly Father. Those are the two.
Right. And by the way, just think about how stupid that is. Neither one of us claim to be the brightest tools in the shed. But how can a father be a Lord? I mean, they're absolute at the far end of the spectrum. A Lord is someone you bow down to, you have to obey.
I got to interrupt you there.
Yes, yes.
You're using rational thought.
Okay, yeah, I'm sorry. I apologize.
Yes.
We're having a religious discussion. I can't do that.
Yes, that's right. Your apologies accepted. Don't Don't do that again.
Okay, so her great controversy was actually her first, and she had trances. I mean, she fell into these trances, and at the end of every trance, she would spell out dark or darkness.
Yes.
So she was having satanic trances, demonic trances, and she was calling them godly inspiration, and she was part of this warfare.
She had no premonitions when these would occur. And sometimes there'd be 3 or 4 days afterwards that she needed to recover.
Yeah, kind of like Paul and Muhammad when they had their encounter with Satan. They needed days to recover.
And as soon as she recovered enough, she immediately said, she was a prolific writer, absolutely prolific.
Mm-hmm.
And the network she had surrounding her were all very, very educated people, with Kellogg being right up there in the White organization. And they were all publishers.
You're talking about Kellogg as in the cereal brand, the grain and cereal brand.
Well, his whole family. He and his brothers were just tremendous in newspaper publishing, editing.
Right.
And especially the new word was the revival of the 1844 disappointment.
Right. Why don't you explain the 1844 disappointment where she got that wrong? Why don't you explain what that was all about?
I don't have that much time.
Okay. How about a summation?
Every reformist since Luther had made efforts to predict the future.
Right.
And they
which you can't do, by the way, without an understanding of Hebrew. You can't, with an understanding of Hebrew and the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, it is extremely easy to predict the future. Without it, it's impossible.
But these people did. They were sea captains. They were major political people. And the biggest one of the bunch predicted that Jesus would return in, August, September, the middle of the summer in 1844.
Oops.
And they all gathered at Great Falls.
Hang on, Don. We'll be back in a moment. To Shattering Mist, we're having a conversation with Don, who was the head deacon at a large Seventh-day Adventist church, and didn't go along with the program, decided that he would actually think and try to be rational, and that ruffled a lot of feathers. So, Don, you're in the middle of telling us that about the great disappointment that became the incentive to create the Seventh-day Adventist, because the great disappointment was really part of the Jehovah's Witness movement and the like, and all of a sudden they lost all credibility.
Yes, and that was the reason that they lost, and she came along and revived William Miller's mistake in saying that she had testimonies that revealed that Jesus would return in the future, but she capitalized on the tremendous power that he had starting in 1820. He had revival meetings that just were unbelievably huge.
Yeah, and all, of course, all around a lie, by the way, which is really sad that so many people gravitate to a lie.
Oh, yes. And she, the interesting thing here, a little sidebar.
Yes.
Is that she insisted that parts of Deuteronomy and Leviticus were her foundation to establish the gold of the ten commandments and and the Sabbath. And those are the only parts that she claimed ever to have anything to do with the Old Testament.
Yeah. What's really funny here is, of course, that it reminds me of the Hebrew Roots movement. They get one thing right, and they build a new religion out of the one thing that they have corrected to get right, and yet they leave all the rest of the wrong there. And you know, Helen White here, she recognized, okay, he was wrong on his date, but he was right about everything else, was her basic conclusion. So let's build off of that, when in fact he was wrong about everything. And the fact is, it is absolutely impossible to know who Yahusha is. You won't even know his name. And you will have absolutely no idea when he last was here, what he did, and when he's going to return, unless you understand Hebrew and the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. It's impossible to know otherwise, and it's absolutely simple to know when you read the Torah, prophets, and Psalms in Hebrew.
And that's what I wanted to do. And I was mildly, shall we say, excommunicated.
We don't want to get that truth, and the truth is really going to mess us up. If somebody goes and actually examines Yahweh's testimony, learns his name, and hears what he has to say, oh boy, we're in serious trouble. Everything disappears. Right. The Trinity is gone. The New Testament is gone. Jesus is gone. Christ is gone. The resurrection is gone. Christmas is gone. Easter is gone. Everything. I mean, you lose it all when you start reading the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. So they figured that it was easier to lose you than it was to lose their religion.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, and I had to step out, and I went over to Claremont University, the Claremont School of Theology, and I got a little bit of encouragement there that they had actual pictures and plates of some of the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yeah, you know how they got them? You know how they got them? It's an interesting story, really. The Huntington Library. The Huntington Library in Southern California. Involved in a real tremendous conspiracy. And the conspiracy was that the Dead Sea Scrolls were, even though they were found in Israel, they were given over to the control of Muslims and the Roman Catholic Church. Well, Muslims and the Roman Catholic Church both recognized that these scrolls, if published, destroy the credibility of their religion amongst all informed, rational people. And so the last thing that the Roman Catholic Church and the Muslims wanted to do was to reveal the content of the Dead Sea Scrolls. So they were found in 1955. And by 1985, you didn't have even 0.1% of them published.
And I went to the Huntington Library about 1955, 56, and 57, and I ran into a stone wall there. They backed out of really wanting to publish them.
Right. So what happened is that, and I one time I was articulate in terms of all the names, and I don't know them anymore, but one entity did publish, but they didn't publish the scrolls. They published a mathematical a formulation of discrepancies between the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Masoretic text. And a really shrewd mathematician was then able to take what they published and recreate what's actually in the scrolls. We'll return with Don and the Dead Sea Scrolls after the break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a conversation with Don regarding the Dead Sea Scrolls and the death knell that they portend for Christianity, is particularly in Don's case, the Seventh-day Adventist, who asked him to leave rather than endure the death blow that those that testimony would give to their religion. I did slightly misspeak. I use 1955 as the time of the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. That's only partially accurate. They were found between 1946 and 1956. It's really over a 10-year period. Huntington Library.
You're right. But what I was saying, they were discovered by the Huntington Library and brought to the United States by their efforts in 1955, 56,
And yeah, what happened? What happened with the Huntington Library is a little more of a complex story. They became one of their staffers became involved in publishing a recreation of the text of the Dead Sea Scrolls through a mathematical formula that was gave people for the first time access to the text of them, and that formula the person came up with based upon the research was extraordinarily useful. Then following that, the Huntington Library came to possess, because someone working on it that was just disgusted by the Muslims and the Roman Catholic Church, provided the Huntington Library with many thousands of photographs that had not been published of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the head of the Huntington Library said, the world has the right to know this information. Even though these photographs are copyrighted and they are not our possession, we are going to publish them because the world has the right to know. And they published thousands of photographs of the Dead Sea Scrolls.
And I had those.
But yes.
I didn't have any way to translate them. And the Huntington Library was not interested in any way in what we would now call an interlinear.
Right.
And I got a Hebrew dictionary, which was absolutely Greek to me.
There you go.
And so I just kept poking and poking and poking and found no, zero help until Logos published. And from there on, it was downhill for me. It was downhill from there. Yes.
Logos is a software company. I used to recommend their product. I don't anymore because it's 90% of what you get in their product, maybe 95%, is counterproductive. But nonetheless, they do make a product where they have an electronic version of the Dead Sea Scrolls. You can click on a word and it'll take you to lexicons that will describe that word for you. I study the Dead Sea Scrolls, the most comprehensive analysis of them and I probably have 20 books on the Dead Sea Scrolls, but the one that I use the most is just called the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible. It is published by Ebrig Flint and Ehrlich. Yeah, and the reason that I like the Dead Sea Scroll Bible is because all it attempts to do is two things. For each book that's part of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, it will describe how many manuscripts and portions of manuscripts and the conditions of those manuscripts that were found in the Qumran collection. So you have an idea of the scope of them, and they will attempt to date each of them. And the second, so it gives you a really good idea as to how much material we have to deal with. Then the second thing they will do is they will then publish the sections of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms that are extant, that are available from the Qumran collection of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, and then they highlight in italics where the Dead Sea Scrolls differ from the Masoretic text, and then they footnote that, and you can go down and you can say, all right, this is what the Masoretic text says, this is what's in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and then all you have to do is translate and substitute the Dead Sea Scrolls word and translate it in lieu of the Masoretic text, and now you have the oldest available witness.
That's why I put in my introduction the fundamental teacher is the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible by Ehrlich.
Yes.
And it does exactly what you said. Now then, Word Search 10 is a very powerful tool for an interlinear, and it comes with the basic package, and it is absolutely as good as the Logos for hundreds and thousands of dollars less.
Yeah, and by the way, so we can talk about, so the source is, in fact, if you email that to me, Don, I'll actually promote that tool on the show and on the site. But so that we understand, we don't want anyone to think that you go off and you buy a hard copy of Ehrlich's collection of the Dead Sea, that it all it is a tool in your arsenal, because the translation in Abeg is no better than any other English translation.
That's right.
All they do is they highlight the words that are different between the Masoretic text and the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, the advantage of that is that there are many tools out there that provide marvelous help making our time more efficient and effective in translating the Masoretic.
Yes.
And so now if you know where the Masoretic and the Dead Sea Scrolls differ, then you can use those tools, but yet still rely on the older manuscripts.
Yes.
Yes.
That's where I was so discouraged. About 2009, I was so deeply involved in the Masoretic that it became confusing. And
yes.
Then I realized that what you were saying is that the actual Dead Sea Scrolls Hebrew is the only way to go. So I gave up the Masoretic and went back to the Paleo Hebrew.
Yeah. Now there's another issue too. There's another issue too, John, Don, that since we're talking about this, we need to share with our listeners. You don't just have to correct the Masoretic text for the variations that are found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Because, by the way, the Masoretic text is a textual line that goes through Babylon. It was rabbis maintaining the text of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms in today's Iran for generations, and then bringing it back. In fact, the oldest copy we have of the Masoretic text is from the 11th century CE. So its heritage goes through Babylon. The Dead Sea Scrolls, of course, are all manuscripts that were copied within Yisrael, and the oldest of them dates to about 250 BCE. So it predates the Masoretic text by 12 or 13 centuries. But beyond, and it's in the right place. But there's another problem with the Masoretic text that is not highlighted by the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible. And that is the Masoretes pretended as if the Hebrew language did not have five vowels. But it does. It has five vowels. There's 22 letters. Five of those letters are vowels. And so they wanted to disguise many things. And so one of the ways they could promote their religion and disguise things such as Yahweh's name is to pretend as if those letters were not vowels, so that they had to vocalize, which is the whole concept of the Masoret. They had to vocalize the text. So the Masoretic supplies vowels as opposed to just looking at the vowels that are in the actual text. So if you want to use even the Masoretic text where it agrees with the Dead Sea Scrolls, you still have to peel away the Masoretic, the rabbinical vowel pointing, and get down to the letters themselves, and what do those letters themselves convey. So it's a lot of work.
Oh, yes, yes. Oh, speaking of a lot of work, do I have my fellow supporters online?
You do. Frank is the only one that can actually speak to us, because we only can have two people at a time up on the switchboard.
Oh.
Richard is listening, but is muted at the moment, because if we were to take Richard, we would disconnect Frank.
Hi there.
Well, give me up and
okay.
Put Richard on.
Yeah, there's Frank.
Hey,
all right, we have Frank and Richard.
Hey, I just wanted to say, too, in talking about the Masoretic text, that there are lots of people in Christendom and other places that use the numerical system to prove that certain things are happening. But
right.
When you're using the numerical system, Masoretic text,
yes,
they're using a false set of
correct.
Numbers, because
correct.
The numbers don't match with the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yeah, in fact, that whole concept of using numerology to convey hidden meanings, that's Kabbalah. That's spiritualism. It is demonic. You ought not be doing it. When somebody is playing that game, you really ought to tell them to stop it. Now, that's not to say that there aren't repetitive numeric patterns throughout the Torah. There are.
Right.
But there are none of those that are designed to reveal prophecy. They're designed to affirm Yahweh's name, Yahusha's name, Yahweh's message and inspiration. And so I have found many numerical patterns that simply say, yeah, I authored this, and I had to actually create the language for these patterns to work to underscore the importance of my name. Like, for example, Yahweh's name appears exactly 7,000 times in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. And if you take the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, and you were to translate it into and publish it like a normal book, that would be, it averages 7,000 or 7 times a page.
Right.
Over those 7,000 times that it appears. So there are some repetitive numbers, but you have to be really careful. The Masoretic text is not reliable. You know, you probably know, Frank, because you've done the study, but the one book that we have totally complete among the Qumran collection is the Great Isaiah Scroll, Yashaya.
Right.
And so I used the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible, which highlights discrepancies between the Masoretic text and the Dead Sea Scrolls, to determine the frequency of error. Now, I'm a guy, I just love math.
Right.
And what I found is 1 out of every 13 words were changed. So the difference between the Masoretic text and the oldest manuscript of Yashaya, Isaiah, is that 1 in every 13 words is different. Now, on top of that, you have to add all of the vocalization changes that were made. But still, 1 in 13 words, you know, compared to the Christian New Testament, where there's 200 to 300,000 discrepancies, more discrepancies than there are words, the Masoretes weren't terrible in terms of their fidelity. But they were clever. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a conversation with Frank, with Richard and Don about the Dead Sea Scrolls. And one of the things, Frank, that since you mentioned prophecy and the Masoretic text, the problem that Helen White had, the problem that the Jehovah's Witnesses had, and the reason that they got their dates wrong is they're all reading English translations, and they're only paying attention to the so-called Christian New Testament, which is almost all erroneous. And it puts them in a position where they're really clueless. The only way you're going to know the timeline and Yahweh's plan is to be able to read the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, and to get it as accurate as you can by working through your own translations and a correction for what the Qumran scrolls say when the Masoretic text differs from it. One of the things that I'll have you guys comment, one of the things I was thinking about this morning, guys, it is obvious that Yahusha is going to return in year 6000 Yah, which on our pagan calendars would be 2033 on the Day of Reconciliations, which on our pagan calendars occurs at sunset on October 2nd. There is a possibility, fellas, that what I have surmised previously about the last possible time for the Teruah harvest being the fall of 2026 on the celebration of Yom Teruah, the fall that the tribulation begins, you know, there's really the possibility that we might have to endure the first 3 years, 3.5 years of the tribulation. And, you know, I never really began to think that through until you realize that in the Daniel prophecies regarding the beast and the tribulation and this time, there it's really broken into the Great Tribulation is the last 3.5 years.
Right.
It's not the whole time. It's not all 7 years. The Great Tribulation, where the beast really has sway over the earth and where Yahweh's presence is removed from the earth, that's the last 3.5 years.
Yeah, I prefer that evacuation comes when the spirit leaves, take us out of here too.
Yeah, but the spirit leaves with us. So, you know, as I considered and we went over in great detail, the Yeshaya 17 prophecy about how the Syrian civil war ultimately leads to the dismemberment of Israel and then to the gleaning, which is the Teruah harvest, happening after Israel is sacrificed. And yet the Daniel prophecies speak of the tribulation really beginning when Israel is sacrificed. I strongly suspect that we are going to have at least a year, two, and maybe even three, more than we think, that we will continue to be witnesses during the first 1, 2, or 3 years of the tribulation.
Of course, the objective that Yah is after is we are the only voice that is
correct
going to tell somebody about Yah and to
correct
point them to him as opposed to all of the false religions.
Correct.
I'm
correct
speaking of every religion that
right
has
yeah
ever been
correct
known or named from the beginning of time is these will be the only voices that will still be speaking out
correct
and actually directing
correct
us, as Yahusha
right
did,
right
directing us to look at Yah, to pay
correct
attention to him, to
correct
what he says, to his
that's
word.
Correct. What that means, the longer we stay here, the better for everyone concerned. And God has an obligation as dad, as our father, to remove his children before the time that that the beast, which is really Christianity, growing out of the old Roman Empire and with heavy doses of Paul, when the beast holds sway and Yahweh says, "I'm out of here. You're all too disgusting. I'm going to return on my stated day, but between now and then, you're all on your own." During that 3.5 years as a father, he has to remove his children.
Right.
And so he's going to, but he doesn't have to remove his children until really the middle of the tribulation when all hell breaks loose.
Hey, the guys that are saying you stay for and you don't stay for are all kind of connected, even though they may not know it.
That is correct. So
hey, I want to talk about Richard and see if Richard can stay with us. Just to flip over to the next hour.
Yeah, we will be. We'll be back after the commercial break, and we look forward to continuing this discussion with Don, Richard, and with Frank after the news and commercial break.